Session number 14806, Edmund Murray.
Slide number 80.
To get one of you, this was a test for you to get into the airport at.
I had to get into India without papers. Mm. Because they either couldn't or they wouldn't assume as papers, you know, in China. And so I got a GI's uniform.
Right.
If you like, you know. It was in the beige thing, you know, in not tweed, something like that.
Yes.
In any case, with boots and a cap, a forage cap, and a tie, khaki tie, and the whole outfit, but without any badges of recognition or anything like this, you see.
Yeah.
So, on a British transport plane, which was in Kunming, it was a DC-10.
DC-3.
Dakota, that's right. And inside there were no seats at all, you know. There were a couple of iron things to sit on. Iron seats, I suppose they were, but they didn't have any cushions. And I think there was a blanket. And there was only one other passenger, Major Clark. Major Clark. Might have been Major Brown. But in any case, he was ancient compared with me, but he was in uniform, in British general staff uniform, I believe, if I remember. And so he sat down, we introduced ourselves, you see, and that introduced ourselves, and that was the totality of the conversation that we had for the rest of the trip, the several hours that it took. But we were frozen, absolutely frozen. And we weren't passing over the highest of the Himalayas, of course, but we were even probably called the foothills, possibly. But there was snow covered, and it was really beautiful, but it was blooming cold. And there was no access to the pilot's cabin or anything like this. There was no heating on, and we were absolutely frozen. But nevertheless, it didn't last, you know, for a fortnight. Flew over the Himalayas and then landed on the other side of the Himalayas at, I'm not sure, Srinagar. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Srinagar, refueling. And from there we flew to Dum Dum. Landed at Dum Dum and the Major went off on his own. And I approached the British lot, you see. There were two gates. There was a British gate here and the American gate along there, you know, maybe 20 yards, 50 yards, maybe 20 yards away, that's all. And both of them, of course, had personnel dealing with people going through the gates. The wire fence, which was about 10 foot high, I suppose. And it was quite impressive, really. Except that when I went to the British, you see, they saw me in American uniform. And so I said, well, you know, before I could say a word, no, mate, yours is up there, you see. And so I went up there, and I told them that I was British, but they didn't want to know anything. I spun them a story, and they let me through. And I was into...
What did you say, roughly? Oh, well,
I'm sure that I said that the British didn't... they had somebody there that was being interviewed...
right.
You know, and all this sort of thing, and that they were too occupied, you see, to do this sort of thing. And what's more, I was dressed as an American, I should really go through the American gate, even although I was British, something like that, you see. I spun to the American GI, and I told them that I'd come from the American weather station at Puerfu, and that was more or less a passport to get through, a code word, a password to get through. And so I got through without any trouble at all into Calcutta. And then, there was a jeep waiting for me.
Ordered, yeah, right.
You see? So I got at the jeep and I was run into Calcutta, where I was introduced to the, I prefer not to mention his name, the colonel in charge. You know, you never know, it might be Official Secrets Act. But he was, you know, he welcomed me very much indeed, and he told me that I'd have about 3 days in Calcutta. which would, and he gave me an advance on my pay in order to buy civilian clothes rather than the GI uniform that I had. And so I bought shorts and shirts and things like that, you see. As a matter of fact, on numerous occasions I went around in Calcutta then, and later on when I came back in August, as a sometimes a captain, sometimes a major. That depended on what, you know, where I was going to.
Who you're having to mix with.
Where I, yes, with whom I was going to mix. And so, you know, they were mainly khaki, it was khaki outfits mainly that I bought, except that I did buy a civilian suit, light summer suit.
Where did you stay then?
Oh, the officer's mess.
Right.
There was an officer's mess
and
there.
That was quite grand.
And then, now wait a minute, the officer's mess was only part of the intelligence set up on Ballygunge, which is a residential part. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the next door and opposite was Pandit Nehru's residence, and the next property along here on the right-hand side was a famous Italian, famous Indian writer. Oh, it's not terribly important, but I had several conversations with him. Rabindranath. But he's
okay.
Universally known.
And so you were staying in the officer's mess. And
now this is not the officer's mess was part of this establishment.
Ah.
This is the headquarters, if you like, of the clandestine intelligence.
Right.
In Calcutta or in India.
Mm.
This is the headquarters because we had the stores department there, we had the officers' mess, and all the other, the radio and all the rest of it was there, do you see?
Did it say it had its own officers' mess?
Yes.
All right.
And it was surrounded.
This wasn't the central mess?
No, no.
No. Okay.
This was an officers' mess, and specifically for those engaged in clandestine activities.
So how many people were there, roughly speaking?
Well, as a matter of fact, when I came back in August, I was to run the officers' mess. And so there was a continual movement.
So how many people normally were there?
About half a dozen, that's
half
all.
Half a dozen, yeah. And I mean...
RAF, Navy...
And were those just the permanent staff? Or were
No. There was a permanent staff there. There was Harry Brown, who was Q. And I was Q too, if you like.
Mm.
But also in charge of the officer's mess.
When you came back?
When I came back in August. And so there was a permanent staff there. And what's more, there was a 10-foot fence around.
Mm.
And it was all barbed wire at the top.
Did they have non-commissioned help there as well? Yeah.
Yes, there were non-commissioned officers there. And one particular non-commissioned officer was in charge of the guard duties.
Right.
Because there was a guard. There was
a
native guard inside and out. Mm. Inside and out of this locked door. And there was sufficient... There was also a bigger gate, which was also locked, of course, because we had transport there. We had jeeps, do you see.
And what? So you were put in charge of the training there?
Not there.
Ah.
After I was there for about 2 or 3 days, that's all. And sleeping in the mess, sleeping there, do you see.
Mm.
There was accommodation.
Mm.
Then I was ordered downtown. The colonel wanted to see me, and so I went down there. Right, he said, tickets. You know, there's a jeep outside, a lorry. No, mm. There's a jeep outside. Back to, I didn't drive myself then.
Mm.
Back to Ballygunge, pick up your effects. And then he said, down to Howrah train station, and then end train for Puri.
Which is the training
Puri. Train. That's down on the Bay of Bengal.
Mm.
And then from Puri, once arrived there, of course, there was transport waiting for me there. With Major R, I was taken over from him, and he was there waiting for me with a jeep, with transport. I think it was a 1500 rate, as a matter of fact. And from there, we went right down to the seashore, where there was this lovely bungalow, several bungalows, as a matter of fact, accommodation for those agents who were being trained to be dropped behind the Japanese and Burma line.
So you got an advance on pay. Did you, I mean, did you try and get in touch with your family? I would have thought that would have been the first thing to do.
Well, I can't remember. I'm sure I did immediately. But I hadn't noticed.
Did you cable them? I would have thought they might have given you facilities to cable them or receive cables.
Yes. Yes, you're dead right. They didn't cable. They sent a radio message to London. And London then, of course, got in touch with my family. That's how it happened.
Right. And what did your family think had happened?
I've never mentioned that, as a matter of fact. I mean, very, very important thing. Yes, suddenly, now I remember that they did get in touch with my family. And to tell us, you know, tell them that I was okay and in India. And then,
had they received any letters from you during this time? You said that you wrote regularly.
Yes.
Did they get through?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No.
And?
They hadn't had news from me for a long, long time.
Right. And then you exchanged correspondence, did you?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But of course, knowing my position, you know, I wasn't able to tell them very much, really.
I just sent them love and kisses. I can't tell you what I'm doing.
Love and kisses.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what did you make of all this suddenly? Coming from being a lowly legionnaire or a legion sergeant in the appalling conditions in Indochina and the march and all this various precursors of that, what did you make of being wound up in this?
Well, I was overwhelmed.
Probably quite plush British, very British setup. Establishment, being one of the hierarchy.
Yes, as I said, I was absolutely overwhelmed by it. But then what I said to myself is that they require somebody like me, do you see, who's who's been in a position in the French Foreign Legion of a responsibility and all the rest of it, and speaking these languages and knowledge of arms and ammunition and this sort of thing. And how to conduct oneself in the jungle, for instance, and jungle warfare and all this sort of thing. Do you see this? They weighed in the balance, and I came out, you know, and they had a favorable impression of me. Mm. And there was no beating about the bush, do you see? This was, woof, you're in, and you know, the rank of major or civilian officer with the same sort of responsibility and priorities. And the same thing in Calcutta, meet up with the colonel who's in charge of the whole ISLD business. And two or three days, woof, off, in command of a training camp. Now, the training camp was, I suppose, although they didn't know at the time, they suspected that, in fact, the first coded telegram that I got on the first night was to the effect that they expected the Japanese to surrender in the not too far distant future. You see? And so, the major that I was taken over from, we were delighted at this news, you see, because it was very hopeful. And so he said, I don't suppose he'd be down here very long anyhow. But he said, for tonight, he said, I'm going, the news is good, let's have a party. You see? And so he said, I tell you what, you get the girls, and I'll get the booze. And so I took a driver and the 1500 rate, and I told him, where are the girls? Now then, down there it's wonderful, absolutely wonderful, beautiful sandy beaches, and there you've got the Bay of Bengal and the sunshine, and so it's a holiday place really, you know, for the Calcutta people, although it's must be 250 miles away. But lots of Europeans used to go down there and stay in this 3 or 4 star hotel, a beautiful hotel. And so the major said, well, you know, there's an hotel along there. He said, and I know for a fact that there are at least four girls there. You know, it'd be nice to have them. And then he said, after that, he said, there's Ma Brown's place, Ma somebody's place. I've got it in the book. Ma somebody's place, anyhow. And she's got a bungalow, and she gets guests down there, you see. And it's a very, very respectable place. Go down and see Ma, we'd say Ma Brown. Yes. Go down and see her afterwards, because there's a honeymoon couple there. You see. So I said, okay. And that'll be about enough, he said. And he said, in the meantime, he said, I'll get the drinks. And he said, I'll get the record player and all the rest of it. And we'll have a party, you see. And so off I went to the hotel. The Gary driver knew where the hotel was, do you see. And so we went there. And I went in there, and there's a reception there, do you see. And so I said, could I see the manager, please? And so the manager came. And I said, there were four girls there at the bar. I could see them through. And there were four girls sitting at the bar. And I said, oh, I feel that these are the girls I want to see, do you see? And so the manager said, well, what do you want to see them about? I said, you know, I just want to see them. I'm going to invite them to a party. Oh, he said, how nice for them. Let me introduce you. And so he went there. There was no introduction at all. I just said to them, you know, I would like a gin and tonic, first of all. And so I was served a gin and tonic with ice and lemon. And I've come to invite you to a party. And I said, Major so-and-so sends me down. Oh, how lovely to see you. They were delighted. Now, remember, this is a wonderful place, you know, for the beach, which is not too far away. Although it was a couple of miles away from the bungalow, at least. So I said, I've got the transport outside, a 1500 rate, if you don't mind. No, used to that. And so out we go, finish our drinks, out we go, into the buggy, and off we went. And I deposited them, you see, at the bungalow. Took them in. And, of course, the major knew them and welcomed them. And there they were. Drinks were being served. And a place was being cleared, you see, for the dancing. This was the training place, you see, for all these, I suppose there were about a dozen
trainees.
Trainees. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of Chinese, and there was one Frenchman. He should have been at Force 36, like, but he wasn't. He was with us. And, the rest were, there were two or three Indians. And, they weren't real Indians. They were...
What, Anglo Indians?
Like Gurkhas, you know. They were natives, do you see. From the frontiers, probably, you know. They were fighters, like...
Yes.
I imagine them as Sikhs or something like this, do you see. The Indians, for me, you see, they were zero. They were Pankawalas and that sort of thing. Whereas there were certain, like the Gurkhas and the Sikhs and the Afridis, one knew that they were a warlike race, do you see, and quite apart from the Indians, who were very, very soft and docile. And so we had about a dozen trainees there. And there I land with the four girls. Then back into the jeep, do you see, back into the no, this time I take the jeep down to Mrs. Brown's. It was Mrs. Brown's. So I go down there, and I ring the bell, and I step into the foyer, and from the reception desk on the left-hand side comes this very, very chubby coloured woman, you see, and she's Ma Brown. And I introduced myself, and I said, I'm taking over from the major. Oh, yes. Oh, well, happy to meet you, and all that sort of thing, you see. And she knew the major, who often went down there, apparently, with his girlfriends, I suppose. But in any case, I said, you've got a honeymoon couple here. And so she said, honey, no. No honeymoon couple, sir. Oh, I said, but he said that there was a honeymoon couple. She said, no. And then through there, because this is a bungalow and there's lots of bamboo tiles about and bamboo roof and all this sort of thing and potted bamboos and bamboos all over the place. But there on the tables were... bamboo tables, you know, lots of raffia and all that sort of thing. And there I could see a couple having a drink, you know, sitting there. And I said, well, that's probably the honeymoon couple. She said, no, sir, not the honeymoon couple. Well, I said, perhaps you'd like to introduce me to them. They say, I'd like to bring them to take them to a party. And so she said, all right, sir, Mr. Murray, they say, come on. And she went forward, and I was introduced as Mr. Murray. And I didn't get their names at all at the time. And so I sat down. And I ordered a drink, and Ma Brown brought it down, brought it along. Do you see, there's another gin and tonic. And so I said, would you be the honeymoon couple? So they looked at me and said, no, no. A certain coolness reigns then, do you see. And so, you know, let's have another drink. So we have another drink. And I said, now, are you sure you're not the honeymoon couple? Well, I said, it doesn't matter a halfpenny, really. I said, I've come to invite you to a party, do you see, along at the bungalow. And so they said, oh, that's lovely, lovely. You know, yes, we'd love to come. And she was nicely dressed up and powdered and very chic. But he hadn't shaved, you see, and so he said, well, if you'll excuse me, I'll go and shave first, you see. And so off he went. And so I said to her, I said, you are the honeymoon couple, aren't you? And so she said, well, Mr. Murray, I can see this is going on all night. I'll put you in the picture. We're both married, but we're not husband and wife. I didn't know what a honeymoon couple was. Apparently that was common parlance out there. And so, you know, eventually we went along. I took them along to the bungalow and promised them to see that when they wanted to leave, you know, I was there. And I wasn't going to drink too much, and because I was in charge, I was the boss. Mm-hmm. And there, sitting on a sofa, were the four girls that I'd brought from the hotel. Oh. And so I said, well, now I'm Eddie Murray, you see, and who are you? And so there they were sitting, and so the first one told me her name, the second one told me her name, the third one told me her name, and shook hands, and the fourth one told me her name, Inge. And so I said, Inge? Golly. It's a name I'll always remember as long as I live, I said, because she was the most beautiful girl. But the main thing was that when I landed from fighting the Japanese in the jungle in Indochina and China, I said, there she was in Kunming, offering me a wonderful cup of tea. I shall never, ever forget Inge, where she said, I'm Inge, the one that gave you the cup of tea. But I said, Inge was blonde. Well, she said, that's all. I've dyed me hair. Oh. She was a brunette. And so we had fun that night. And, during the time that I was there, it was hard work. I had lots and lots of coding to do. And
you did the coding yourself?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Of messages. You didn't have a cipher clock?
No. Really? I did all the ciphering and responses and all the rest.
What was the syllabus that they went through, these chaps, roughly speaking?
Lectures. We had lecturers, you know, and I was able to lecture them on the appearance of the Japanese and their seeming tactics in specific conditions, shall we say. That is, in the jungle and you know, in the open, quite often. Mm. And there wasn't very much more that I could tell them, really. And that was the main thing. On languages, do you see, on Burmese languages and Malayan dialects and things like that, we had people to teach them.
How long did the course last for?
It was usually 4 or 5 weeks only.
4 or 5 weeks only. And why were these particular people selected? The courses?
Mainly they were volunteers.
How were they selected? Yeah, that's the same question.
Well, quite a number of them, of course, were Burmese, or Malayan, and Chinese. And so they had their reasons, you know, for going there. Their nationality reasons, you see. They wanted to do the fighting, and they'd been chosen by by scouts, if you like, wandering around the different villages or the different, and they were all of a certain quality, you know. They weren't just farmers or anything like this. Mm. They were mainly commercial people, I think.
Mm. And what? Well educated.
Well educated, yes, indeed. And of course, they'd been probably, from what I was to learn, they did, quite a number of them had been employed or involved in the consulates and the various consulates and embassies.
So they're...
And military personnel.
What are our consulates?
Yes.
They're from some sort of official background, yes. In a way.
They had an official background, most of them.
And what sort of age were they?
I've got a photograph. Anything between 25 and 35, 40.
Really?
It's quite reasonable ages, you know.
And so how many instructors were there?
Including myself, four.
Four. And how many?
At that particular time. But remember that the news was very good.
All right. So it was scaling down.
It was scaling down, right. Yes.
And what... how many instructors, how many pupils, how many trainees?
Yeah, there were at least a dozen.
A dozen?
A dozen,
right.
To 14.
Right. How many... did you have admin staff?
No.
Who driver?
I did. You know, there were a couple of drivers, but I did most of the administrative work.
Right.
You know, kept the records and that sort of thing, names, and how long they'd been there, and when they went off, and how they were going off, and where they were dispatched to.
And what about subjects like explosives and small arms and practical?
That, of course, I was able to give them quite a lot of instruction on the use of small arms. We had a firing range down on the beach, facing the sea, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And with long split bamboo, you know, cover all the way down. So, and this was in their sort of winter period, their off-season period.
But is that cold, really, or?
Oh, no. Beautiful.
No.
It was just a season when people didn't go down there. It wasn't too hot in Calcutta, do you see?
Okay. And what about practical training, like? Explosives.
Jumps.
Oh, jumps.
Well, they went from there to an airfield where they were taught the jumps, jumping. But quite a number of them, of course, were destined not to jump, but to go by sea, by submarine, to certain places, and then in rubber boats, you see, to the coast.
Did you do watermanship skills there?
I went through a 3-day course myself.
Right.
But I also did 3 jumps behind the Japanese lines in Burma and Malaya.
Did you?
Yeah. During about 5 days period.
When was that?
That was as soon as I got down there. As soon as Raleigh left in 3 days, and for 2 days there was nobody there. One of the trainees. Who seemed a responsible sort of character was put in charge. Calcutta were informed about it.
How did you make 3 jumps behind enemy lines?
From planes, what do you think?
Well, I know, but how did you get back then?
Oh, then? There was transport arranged.
Which was?
Garries and lorries from one place to another to an airfield.
Okay.
But...
This was behind Japanese lines?
The drop was behind Japanese lines. The movement through the jungle was behind the Japanese lines, but moving away from the Japanese lines in a northerly direction, northwesterly direction, to over the frontier and into Malaysia, and then into a lorry, a gharry, 1500 weight or something like that.
Which country were you actually dropped into?
Into Burma at the time. This is before the big slim pushes, you know.
All right, let's see, Burma. I'm trying to. Burma borders Malaya.
Yes, Malaya on this side, right down the thing.
Yes.
Right down the coast, and there's Burma sort of separated. And then on the other side, of course, you've got the Thailand and Laos.
Okay. Right. And
that was terribly exciting.
I'm sure.
You know, but The first one I was practically pushed at.
I wouldn't have wanted to have got involved at all to go back behind Japanese lines.
I was 20, 25, 28 years old, you know, and all my life had been adventure.
Right.
This was just another, just a continuation of the Legion, really.
Okay.
And then, of course, I had a responsibility. I was, you know.
Well, you're in charge.
I'm in charge, yes.
And what were you equipped with then? I mean, you're in combat suit uniform.
Just combat suit, you know, and
Given a firearm?
No epaulets or anything like that.
Were you given a firearm?
I had a firearm. I had a revolver.
Mm. I would have thought that was a bit of a risk from a security point of view, letting the chief instructor drop behind enemy lines.
As I said, you see, the thing is being...